Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasant day and a pleasure to see you all. I want to thank Mr. Fish for his kind words. Service in the church is always a privilege and a pleasure, and it's my wife and I have had wonderful opportunities over the years, and I'm always appreciative and of the privileges we have been given. Also, I want to thank the special music as they come out. You know, through all the years and challenges in the church, one thing I have found, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, that beautiful and inspiring music has been a constant. And I want to thank all those who gave special music today and also at the Feast of Trumpets. It's just absolutely inspiring, and thank you very much. Today, in the message today, I would like to start with a question. When is Christ going to return to this earth? No doubt as we enter into the fall holy days, which pictures a time of Christ eventually returning to this earth, of Satan being locked away, the ushering in of the millennium, the establishment of the New Jerusalem on this earth, and we may think of the times we're in and wonder, are we in the last days? Is Christ's return imminent? Will end time events begin maybe after the feast? Next year? 3 years? What about 5 years? What about, it couldn't be more than 10 years? 20 years? 100 years? And people over time have thought the same thing. There have been many times when mankind thought they were living in the time of the end. I would like to go through a small sample of these events. In AD 156, a man named Montanus declared himself to be the Spirit of Truth, the personification of the Holy Spirit, mentioned in the Gospel of John, and he was to reveal all truth. Montanus quickly gathered followers, including a pair of far-seeing prophetesses who claimed to have visions and ecstatic experiences supposedly from God. In AD 500, Hippolytus of Rome, a 3rd century theologian, supported the oft accepted for the day view that the world was going to end in the year 500. He used a mass of scriptural evidence, including the dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant. In 1000, Christian authority all over the known world predicted the second coming in the year 1000. However, when it didn't happen, it was changed to 1033 because the same Christian authorities claimed they'd forgotten to add the length of Christ's life on this earth, and thus the 1033 was the appropriate time for Christ's return. And the writings of the Burgundian monk Rodolphus Glaber described a rash of mass hysterias during the period of 1000 to 1033. In AD 1349, a group known as the Flagellants claimed that their movement must last 33 and a half years, culminating in the second coming. They persuaded many people that their assertions were true. One chronicle stated, many persons, even young children, were soon bidding farewell to the world, some with prayers, others with praises on their lips. In AD 1688, John Napier, the mathematician who was instrumental in modern-day application of logarithms, applied his mathematics to the book of Revelation and predicted the end of the world in 1688. In 1844, William Miller, a Massachusetts farmer, after years-long study of the Bible, chiefly Revelation and Daniel, concurred that the second coming of Christ would take place between the 21st of March of 1843 and the 21st of March 1844. When this time passed, Miller and his followers set up new times, new dates, and again with failure. Even in modern times, in 1994, Harold Camping, a radio evangelist, wrote the book 1994? In it, Camping says, if this study is accurate, and I believe with all my heart that it is, there will be no extensions of time. There will be no time for second guessing. When September 6, 1994 arrives, no one else can be saved. The end has come. More recently, we've had discussions about the Mayan calendar, that the new era would begin in 2012. But when it didn't happen, a Mayan scholar claimed that the end of the Mayan calendar was actually going to occur between June 3rd and 4th of 2016, saying that the experts had the original 2012 date wrong. Well, wrong again. We may look back at these predictions and may be amused by some of them, but those of who have been in the church for some time can remember the year 1972 and 1975. 1972 is when the tribulation would begin, and 1975 would be Christ's return. The church even published a book entitled 1975 in Prophecy. And for those who've seen it, I still remember it. I think the second to the last page, the black and white penned picture of the bulldozers pushing the bodies into the pit. And I can still clearly recall being an eighth grader coming into the church in the late 60s, and hearing about Christ's imminent return, and I was angry. I was angry because I wasn't going to be given a chance to have a family because Christ was going to return, and I wasn't going to be given the chance to be an adult. There was an energy, wasn't there? For those of you who are here and remember the time, there was an energy as you saw the date coming. But after the date passed, after 1975 passed, there was a silent air of disillusionment by many. Needless to say, predictions about Christ's return in the past are not true. And those who interpret a date and those who continue to interpret dates for the end of the world are in error. For we know that in Matthew 25:13, when Christ was talking about a parable of the 10 virgins, 5 wise, 5 foolish waiting to meet the bridegroom, stated that no one knows the day nor the hour of the return. But what about it? Even though we cannot predict dates, even though we cannot predict the day or the hour, surely we can know the time. Thus, shouldn't we ask ourselves, are we living in the last days? Is this the time of the end? We know that in the Bible, that in the end times, just before Christ returned to this earth, there'll be a time of incredible signs in the heavens. The rise of the beast power and the false prophet. It'll be a time when there'll be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars, and there'll be distress upon the nations. There'll be a time for the king of the south will push against the king of the north. In the time just before Christ returns, during the Great Tribulation, the world will suffer horrors, famine, plagues, death. There'll be much suffering on this earth. Turn to Matthew 24:22. Matthew 24:22. Matthew 24:22, it states, unless those days be shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. The fall holy days pictures a time of Christ's return to this earth, and I believe that it is prudent during this time for us to review the state of humanity, of human society in the time leading up to Christ's return. The state of humanity in the last days. And this is especially true for us because it's important to us to know the state of humanity as we walk and hold on to God's way of life, the treasure he has given all of us. Before we look at some of the prophecies relating to the state of society in the time prior to Christ's return, I think it would be helpful to review why God has provided a glimpse of future events through prophecy. Turn to 1 Corinthians 14:22. 1 Corinthians 14:22. And I would like to read from the New Living Translation. It states in verse 22, "So you see that speaking in tongues is a sign not for believers, but for unbelievers. Prophecy, however, is for the benefit of believers, not unbelievers." Now, the focus of 1 Corinthians 14 is that of speaking in tongues. Paul is pointing out to the Corinthians that God has provided prophecy for those who do believe, for those who walk in the way. But why? But why does God do this? As we conclude this message, I will come back to the scripture, and I believe it will be clear as to why. So what will it be like? What will it be like in the times leading to Christ's return on this earth? Let's review six prophecies relating to the state of humanity before Christ's return. The first, mankind will be living like people were in the days of Noah. Mankind will be living like people were in the days of Noah. Turn to Matthew 24, verse 37. Matthew 24, verse 37. Mankind will be living like people were in the days of Noah. Matthew 24, verse 37. It states in Matthew 24, verse 37, "But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." Now, Chuck Smith, in his C2000 series of Matthew 23 to 24, makes the following observation regarding these sets of scriptures. He is just saying it's going to be like it was in the days of Noah. That is, they were going on with business as usual, right up to the time of God's judgment. They didn't know that until the flood came and took them away. So it will be that people will be oblivious. The world will be oblivious of the return of Christ right until the moment when it comes. Smith goes on by noting that in these sets of scriptures that Christ was not referring to a population explosion in Noah's time, and it relates to the end times, nor to the wickedness of the days of Noah. But in including his commentary on these sets of scripture, he notes the following. "But in reality, the illustration to be just strictly within its context and holding strictly to the context, it was just liking it to the surprise the people had when God's judgment finally came. They did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be." In other words, at the end times, there'll be a normalcy of life. Things will be going on as they always have. Mankind in general will be oblivious of what is happening. Secondly, in our review of prophecies related to the state of humanity prior to the return of Christ, prophecy states that society will experience dramatic growth in knowledge. Society will experience dramatic growth in knowledge. It will be in a time of unprecedented knowledge growth. Turn to Daniel 12, verse 4. Daniel 12, verse 4. Daniel 12, verse 4. It will be a time of unprecedented knowledge growth. Daniel 12, verse 4 states, "But thou, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. But many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." And in our society, and during our lifetime, we've seen a staggering increase in knowledge, in technology, unimaginable to those even 25 years ago. Advances in communications, transportation, medicine, science, electronics, nuclear physics, to name a few, are the products of this age of increased knowledge and opportunity. However, with the increased knowledge, information, people appear to be confused. They're running to and fro, and the to and fro is not limited to just people transporting themselves from one place to another. While it does mean that in the Hebrew, it's something more to do with what's happening in somebody's mind. It could mean that people are casting themselves back and forth as though they're in the midst of a puzzle, a mystery they can't just figure out. And maybe with all the knowledge, all the bombarding of knowledge, that they are confused and stressed, and their minds are flashing back and forth because of all the activity that is going around them. It'll be an incredible time of growth of knowledge, but that does not equate with spiritual understanding. Turn to 2 Timothy 3, verse 7. 2 Timothy 3, verse 7. And in verse 1, Paul notes he's talking about the last days, the people living in the time. And in verse 7, it states, "Always learning and never able to arrive at the knowledge of the truth." Despite man's preoccupation with knowledge and academic pursuits, Paul warns that in the end times, many will be ever learning, yet never coming to the knowledge of the truth. Their desire for knowledge is misdirected, and this desire, this quest, will lead people to look for teachers that fit their understanding and their knowledge base. If we go down to chapter 4 of 2 Timothy, in verse 3, it states the following, "For the time will come that they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up with themselves teacher, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables." Having knowledge, accessibility to a great storehouse of knowledge, does not mean one understands the truth. In the end times, there will be much knowledge, many ideas, many beliefs, but that doesn't mean that what is believed is true. Thirdly, in our review of prophecies related to the state of humanity prior to the return of Christ, prophecy states that those living in the world will experience a time of incredible wealth and trade. It'll be a time of incredible wealth and trade. Revelation 18, verse 9. Revelation 18, verse 9. Those living in the world will experience a time of incredible wealth and trade. Revelation 18, verse 9. And it states, "And the kings of the world who committed adultery with her and enjoyed her great luxury will mourn for her as they see the smoke rising from her charred remains. They will stand at a distance, terrified by her great torment. They will cry out, 'How terrible for you, O Babylon, you great city. In a single moment, God's judgment came to you.'" And I'm reading from the New Living Translation just for some clarity here. In verse 11, "The merchants of the world will weep and mourn for her. There is no one left to buy her goods. She brought great quantities of gold, silver, jewels and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet cloth, things made of fragrant thyme, wood, ivory goods, and objects made of expensive wood and bronze and iron and marble. She also brought cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, and bodies, that is, human slaves. In verse 14, "The fancy things you love so much are gone," they cry. "All your luxuries and splendor are gone forever, never to be yours again." Verse 15, "The merchants who became wealthy by selling her these things will stand out at a distance, terrified by her great torment. And they will weep and cry out, how terrible it is for that great city. She was clothed in the finest purple and scarlet linens, decked out with gold and precious stones and pearls." And in a single moment in verse 17, all the wealth, the city is gone. The above passage in Revelation shows there will come a time when Babylon, the current financial system and human governing system, will be destroyed. And what do we see? The merchants are upset because their luxuries have been laid waste. The wealth is gone. We live in a world of wealth, wealth that the world has not seen before. Many of us have the opportunity to enjoy the opportunities for wealth within the current system. Enjoying the fruits of one's labor is not wrong. Yet prophecy shows that God will destroy this economic system because at its core, at its base, is a system contrary to God. Fourthly, in reviewing prophecies related to the state of humanity in the last days, prophecy shows that society's focus will be on the self. Society's focus will be on the self. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. Society's focus will be on the self. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. And we'll go through verse 5. Prophecy shows that society's focus will be on the self. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasures rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. And from such people, turn away." Another translation renders these scriptures as follows: "You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times. For people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving, unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, love pleasures rather than God. They will act religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly." Stay away from people like that. Paul's admonition to Timothy in the second half of verse 5, avoid such people. These five verses, provide an insight what it will be like in the last days. And there are 18 different conditions of man that they're going through in the last days, and really at any time, that we are to avoid. Now I would like to take a close look at these five verses, because I think many times we read through them, but without really thinking what they mean. Verse 1 talks about dangerous and perilous times. The Greek word here used in dangerous in the classical Greek is both of dangerous wild animals and the raging sea. It's Only the other New Testament occurrence is the story of the two Gadarene demoniacs who were savaged and untamed as wild beasts, and whom Matthew describes so fierce that no one could pass away. It is incredibly dangerous time. One commentary makes the following statement about this verse. The characteristics Paul will describe speak not of bad times, but of bad people. We should note that with the hardness or danger at this time in Paul's view to be not war, not famine or diseases, nor any other calamities or ill that befall the body, but the wicked and the depraved ways of men. We see in verse 2 that men will become lovers of themselves. William Barclay provides the following commentary on verse 2. It is no accident that the first of these qualities will be a life that is centered in self. The adjective used is phalutos, which means self-loving. Love of self is the basic sin from which all others flows. The moment a man makes his own will the center of life, divine and human relationships are destroyed. Obedience to God and charity to men both become impossible. The essence of Christianity is not the enthronement, but the obliteration of self. Yet in reality, we don't really need to be encouraged to love ourselves. We naturally have such a love. But neither should we embrace the idea of hating ourselves either. We're to be balanced and realistic about ourselves in our strengths and in our weaknesses. Romans 12, verse 3. It states, for I say, though the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt each one a measure of faith. Those who walk in the way, those of God's family, we must see ourselves as we really are. We are human beings with frailties and strengths and flaws. Verse 2 states that people will be covetous, lovers of money. The covetous are those who are not contented with food or raiment and such things, and if they have such things, what they want more of them. And the desire leads to even wanting more. It's an ongoing cycle, and the striving and the grasping for even more. In other words, it is never enough. And so shall it be in the last days. Paul also points out that people in the last days will be proud, arrogant, abusive. In our day, terms abuse are usually linked with another word, such as child abuse, elder abuse, spousal abuse. Unfortunately, these words are used all too often in our day and age, and so shall it be in the last days. In the last days, children will be disobedient to parents. William Barclay notes the following regarding this aspect of the last days. The ancient world set duty to parents very high. The oldest Greek laws disenfranchised the man who struck his parents. To strike a father was in Roman law as bad as murder. In the Jewish law, the honor for father and mother come on a high list of the Ten Commandments. It is a sign of a supremely decadent civilization when youth loses all respect for age and fails to recognize the unpayable debt and the basic duty that it owes to those who gave it life. People in the last days will also be ungrateful, refusing to recognize the debt they owe to God and to others in this life. Verse 2 ends with unholy, and the Greek word for holy is aniosios, and in this context infers that men will refuse to even recognize the basic decencies in life. It's not so much that man is breaking written laws, but in Greek infers that man will go against unwritten laws that are part and parcel with the essence of life. To the Greek, it was aninosos to refuse burial for the dead, or to have a brother marry his sister. Thus, in the context, man will be acting against the fundamental decencies of life. Verse 3 points out, in the last days, mankind will be heartless. That is, without human affection. Storge, the Greek word used here, is the word used for family love, the love of child for a parent and a parent for a child. It would appear at the end times that mankind will be so set on self that even the closest ties will mean nothing to them. Mankind will be unappeasable, become so bitter that he or she will never come to terms with the person they've had a difference with. They will be slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good. Verse 4 mentions that people in the last days will be treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And finally, in verse 5, they have an appearance of godliness, but denying its powers. In this self-obsessed world of the last days, it appears that people will feel free to have a salad bar religion. They will pick and choose what they want. They will feel free to be very spiritual with no obligation to base their lives on spiritual principles. In the last days, people will despise the power it should have to guide their lives, the power in the sense of rightful authority. And many, many today deny that God has the power to tell them what to do through his word. As we look around us, we can see the characteristics of man foretold by Paul in 2 Timothy. And as time goes on, it will only get worse. Paul notes in verse 13, he states that evil men and imposters will grow worse, deceiving and being deceived. The actions of mankind will not improve over time. They will only steadily worsen as we head towards the last days. Here Paul is acknowledging that human nature is prone to progressive degeneration. In other words, sin has an addictive quality in that sense of relief or satisfaction or pleasure does not last. Thus, to receive the same amount of pleasure before, one has to sink deeper and deeper into the sin. And because of the inclination towards increase, social and religious barriers to immorality within communities have eventually come down. Therefore, each new generation is a more fertile breeding ground for the evils of society, because human nature really provides no impediment to it. As sin, living contrary to God's way, becomes more acceptable in the society, the people will have more difficulty recognizing it. So shall it be in the times leading to the last days. The fifth prophecy that I would like to review today relating to the state of humanity before Christ's return is that prophecy states that mankind will live in a troubled world. Prophecy states that mankind will be living in a troubled world. Matthew 24, verse 3. Matthew 24, verse 3. Matthew 24, verse 3. And I'd like to read from the New Living Translation. Later, Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives. His disciples came to him privately and said, "Tell us, when will all this happen? What sign will be the signal of your return and the end of the world?" And Jesus told them, "Don't let anyone mislead you, for many will come in my name, claiming that I am the Messiah, and deceive many. And you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. Yes, these things must take place, but the end won't follow immediately. Nation will go to war against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and earthquakes in many parts of the world. There will be troubles. There will be religious troubles. We've seen in this in scriptures that there'll be religious confusion at the time. Many will proclaim Christ's message, but there will actually be false messages. And Christ said, we should not be deceived by it. There'll be social troubles. The world will be experiencing wars and rumors of wars, and nations will be in conflict. There'll be climactic troubles, famines, pestilence, disease epidemics, and earthquakes in diverse places. Thus, even though there'll be wealth and trade and an great increase in knowledge, mankind won't be able to solve its problems, and along with that, find itself spiritually confused. Finally, in reviewing prophecies related to the state of humanity in the last days, prophecy shows that people will doubt that Christ will return. People will doubt that Christ will return. 2 Peter 3, verse 3. 2 Peter 3, verse 3. And I would like to read from the New Living Translation. People will doubt that Christ will return. 2 Peter 3, verse 3. Most importantly, I want to remind you that in the last days, scoffers will come, mocking the truth and following their own desires. They will say, what happened to the promise of Jesus' coming again? From before the times of our ancestors, everything has remained the same since the world was first created. If you go back to chapter 2, 1 Peter notes that the church was, and Peter was noted that the church was being infiltrated by false teachers. In verse 4, Peter lets those who believe make the case. Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the belief that Christ won't return, make the case, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continued as they were since the beginning of creation. Haven't we seen that with all the predictions of Christ's return? Isn't it just another prediction? People will follow their own desires in the last days, and they have heard predictions of Christ's return many times before, and even recently. I only gave a very few in the introduction to this message, and nothing ever happened. And such society will scoff at the idea of Christ returning or ever returning at all. So God has provided us a prophetic glimpse of the state of humanity before the return of Christ to this earth. And I would like to go through the prophecies in reverse order. In the last days, there will be those who will scoff at the idea of Christ's return. Mankind will be living in a time of religious confusion and social and climactic trouble. It will be a time where man's focus will be on the self. It'll be a incredible time of wealth and riches. It'll be a time of a dramatic increase in knowledge. But it doesn't mean that people will find the truth. And yet through all of that going on, it'll be like the days of Noah, a time when humanity will be going about its business, oblivious of the time at hand. I guess the best analogy for this is the frog in a pot of hot water. You will note that through this message, I have not stated that the return of Jesus Christ is imminent in relation to our time frame, to our understanding of time. If I did, it would only be my opinion, and frankly, my opinion in this matter is totally irrelevant. We know we live in a world, and for those of us who've been on earth for a while, we can see that it is progressively becoming more self-destructive. And I'm not saying that there's not good going on. And frankly, I have believed we have confused people on this issue, especially our young people over the years, saying the word is evil without acknowledging that there is a lot of good that is done. When I look back at the story of the Garden of Eden, it was the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, not just evil. However, the struggle against evil, man's inhumanity to man, the challenges to human decency, the erosion of godly values is intensifying. And if we take a step back, if we make an honest assessment, many times the good that we are seeing is an attempt to combat the evils within human society. We know we live in a time of great religious confusion and uncertainty. We live in a time of wars and rumors of wars. We live in a time of climatic upheaval, of major hurricanes, of destructive earthquakes. And I guess we can say it seems like we're living in the times leading to the last days. Thus, Christ's return must be in hand, maybe in X number of days, X number of months, X number of years. But we also know that's a danger, because Christ warned us about setting dates, about setting times for his return. And we've only known all too well, and I've known it from my family, that many of those who came in the church expecting him to return in 1975 fell by the wayside. They were scared in the way of believing, and when the time passed, they left because they never built a solid foundation of God's way of life. They faded away. What we can say with certainty is the day will come suddenly, and when people will least expect it, because there are frogs in hot water. They become accustomed to this, what is going on, the evils of the society around them. Turn to Luke 21, verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life, and the day it will come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. I can also say that no one knows of the day. Matthew 24, verse 36. Matthew 24, verse 36. It states in Matthew 24, verse 36, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. The prophecies we reviewed today tell us the state of human society from God's perspective, before Christ returned to this earth, during the time of the last days. But why does God choose to reveal these things through prophecy? Why not just inform people to live a good life and have a relationship with God, and then tell people of the reward of living that way of life? Why is there prophecy about the end times? If you remember, we read from 1 Corinthians 14, verse 22, at the beginning of this message, where it states, so you see that speaking in tongues is a sign not for believers, but for unbelievers. Prophecy, however, is for the benefit of believers, not unbelievers. Prophecy is for believers. Because it's meant to scare us? No, I believe there are two specific reasons why God provides prophecy to those who believe. But in the case of this message, prophecy is about the state of humanity before the return of Jesus Christ. First, prophecy protects us from deception, from being lulled to sleep about what's going on around us. In Matthew 24, Christ speaks about the signs of his coming and the end of the world to warn his family not to be complacent, not to be oblivious of what's going on around them. Whether or not the time of Christ's return is imminent or in a particular time frame that someone has calculated is frankly irrelevant. However, if we're honest with ourselves, we can see the prophecies that we review today are applicable for this day and age. Thus, we should consider our thoughts, our actions, and how we live our life in our society today. Are we aware of society's impact on us? Are we complacent, oblivious to what's occurring? Have we forgotten to sigh and cry for all the abominations the world is going through and the suffering that's going on? Christ states in Revelation 22, verse 12, "Behold, I come quickly." Christ is communicating a sense of urgency to us. We should always be ready, always be diligent, always be awake, not focused on a date, a time in the future. For in reality, none of us know when our own individual time is up. Secondly, the purpose of prophecy is to convey to us the purpose of life, the plan, God's plan for all of mankind. Prophecy reminds us of God's plan and how He is working in the affairs of the nation. It informs God's people of His purposes and exhorts His family to conform their lives to God's goals. And though you see trouble around us, and though we see climactic change, and though we see wars and rumors of war, prophecy calms us and shows us that God's in charge. God is there, and things are going to His plan. Prophecy reminds us of the ultimate goal, to go against what we would logically seek in our human nature and live life to our ultimate purpose, to be a part of the family of the kingdom of God, where our goal is to ultimately serve all mankind. The point of prophecy is not merely for God to reveal the future, for us to get excited about future events, but to serve His family He has called at this time, to provide us a compass at these difficult times, to help us navigate through harsh times, that we do not need to be deceived by the ways that are contrary to God's way of life. We do not need to be confused by the living of the here and now, that we don't need to give up hope when we see man's inhumanity to man, when we see the suffering around us. Prophecy also provides reassurance to all of us that God's plan is not only for us, but for all of mankind. God is on His throne. He's always there for us, even during the challenging times, in the last days, before the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. In conclusion, please turn to Matthew 28, verse 18. Matthew 28, verse 18. And I would like to read from the New Living Translation. It states in Matthew 28, verse 18, "Jesus came and told His disciples, 'I have given all authority in heaven and on earth. Therefore, go make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I have given you. And be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of this age.'"